We'll be right back. Jack Womack.
Good evening. Thank you all for coming.
Much better. Thank you all for coming. Tonight I'll be reading a sort of a greatest hits selection, as it were. This is going to be used later on, so I'll have several pieces taken completely out of context, which I'll try to give some background to. They will likely make as much sense in out of context as they do in context. So. And we'll begin with a section from my first novel, in which the narrator is taking a walk through downtown New York. Now, this would have been downtown New York if 1977 had sort of stayed and just gotten a lot more so over time. I passed through the checkpoint at Canal Street. A sanitation truck roared through the barricade behind me. It stopped at Bowery. The driver raised the truck's bed and dumped its load into the street. Hundreds of bags burst, hitting the ground. The driver returned to his starting zone. Trash pickups in the downtown control zone and the abutting secondary zones were recycled over the wall in the Lower East Side of Twilight Zone, the Barrio de Notch, my neighborhood. It was easy to get into a Twilight Zone. The official name for such an area was an Enterprise Zone, but no one who lived in them called them anything but Twilight Zones. Merengues blared from 1,000 boxes. Druzies had stripped a young girl, shaved her head, and having daubed her in tar, trounced her with long poles. Consorting with army boys, or so suspected, that was the usual treatment for such dalliance. There'd been a blast farther up. Smoke dyed the air brownish blue. Folks perused the bodies in the street, retrieving what might or later prove usable. Someone from on high lobbed a chunk of concrete. It bounced off the hard hat I wore down here. Knees buckling, I moved along, suspecting no personal animosity. Ahead, youths lithely sprang through a restaurant window, followed by additional youths swinging bats, pipes, and old parking meters. Losing their quarry, they upended pedicabs and trampled the riders. An old Pontiac scraped along the street, hauling produce from the Javits Center. The car was tireless. The women pulling had a tough time of it. Nearby, two rascals wedged a boy into a crack between two buildings and took turns playing Johnny and the Pony. At the corner of Grand, a woman straddled a man lying in the walk, caressing him repeatedly with a hammer. Her point seemed moot. I paused to give ear to two accordionists playing Stravinsky's Rite of Spring and gave them each a nickel. One put the change into a plastic capsule and swallowed it so that it might be recovered safely once home. I always went through Chinatown, walking from the tombs. It was the safest route. An army truck bashed through the crowd, lights on, sirens roaring. The home army boys never patrolled Twilight Zones in standard fashion. They'd sooner go into Long Island. Anti-terror units came in periodically for gaiety and for the touch of the multitude. The truck stopped. Soldiers stood up in the back. "Ballet," they drawled, firing into the people. I dove into a nearby doorway, estimating I'd be missed. The soldiers shrieked like ghosts as they reloaded. I edged my head past the corner of the door and looked out. The wire shirt beneath the truck had pulled away on one side. and someone so observant as I tossed in a molly. Seconds later, the truck hurtled into the air, crashing in flames on a group holding the corner of Kenmare. Those troops who survived were extracted from the wreckage by Samaritans, torn and shredded. On Eldridge Street, I slowed. Haphazard blockades of cement blocks, boards, and barrels still filled the intersections tossed across by citizens long lost. I walked the street's middle, avoiding open manholes and excavations. There were no street lights in our zone. They brought good money as scrap. And it was a smoggy night, but I pulled my flash and had no trouble. I passed the hall of a century-old synagogue. Every inch of it was graffitied. There were the usual tags, obscenities, and political messages. U.S. out of North America. My rights or I bite. A better lettered sign stood in the midst of the street, placed by the army years before. Don't touch anything, it read. It could kill you. Smudged handprints nearly obliterated the warning. Heading east on Houston Street, I entered my quarter. People crowded the streets once more, residents of every creed and color, ambient throughout. I walked north on Avenue C. My part of the neighborhood was safe as could be. Ambience tended not to injure others reasonlessly, though when they had reason, they were the most dangerous opponents of all. As I walked through, I felt the sustaining comfort of being in the place where I had grown up, knowing all, and having all known me. The bouncers of the club greeted me as I entered. Being ambient, they dressed as if Halloween Carnival went on year long. Being ambience, they would have been hard to miss in any season. Reuben had no arms, and Lester had no body below the navel. Their agility was so great as the average. If any customer grew testy, except during happy hour, Reuben loosened them up with his hobnails, then Lester leapt on and Windsored. Lester was quite the sweeter of the two. He wore a black reverse mohawk and a domino mask with sequins, the kind Woolworths sells. Reuben, whose hair was uncombed blonde, wore a discarded camouflage jumpsuit, obtained when he had discarded the former wearer. "Hidey-ho," I said. They grinned. "Who hangs and how high, O'Malley?" Lester asked me. "Sky high," I said. "How's biz?" "Bloody fucko." I sat at the bar, nearly ordering my usual, a Pepsi. Then, changing my mind, ordered a triple gin. I hadn't drunk alky in years, but that evening I wished to bib-tuck my mind a spell. The bartender, a young black woman whose right hand consisted of two thumbs joined at the shoulder, was new. I left her a penny tip. The glass was clean and unbroken, and she hadn't thrown it at me. Over the back bar was a scrawled poster listing coming attractions. Tomorrow, Anne Frank, battered children, multiple birth defects. Saturday, celestial palsy, irreversible brain damage, Zyklon B. The club was closed on Sundays. About 20 years after that, and we find ourselves in Elvisy, and this little part describes the basis of the Church of Elvis, and more particularly his followers. Elvi were as locusts, harmless, even funful when singled and suffocating massed. They swarmed into their services and into the mass gatherings they termed Elcons, praying for, talking about, listening to, and posing as the king for days on end, segregating themselves from the world to celebrate their increasing strength. Then, recharge, they'd appear amid the unafflicted populace, proselytizing sans cease, berating their co-workers, distributing illiterate tracts and zines, deadheading computer lines, vandalizing walls and screens with their deconstruction of the word. Dialoguing with Elvi became, inevitably, monologuing. They understood no reference but E, and all else existed but to be measured against his greatness and found lacking. That they believed didn't satisfy. To their eyes, all should want him as desperately, and to the exclusion of everything else. Millions wanted the king now, wanted without cease, full-faithed and overt. But which king? The C of E was one church become many. Its mitosis ensued at conception and seemed primed to split, divide, and resplit unto perpetuity. Each new denomination contained from its birth fresh infidels keen to look askance and thereafter contrary. Take, as example, the Pre-Armyites. Within their ranks were souls believing the rhythms of E's songs to have been irredeemably tainted once accompanied by drums. Others certain that in Recordings Act an impenetrable firewall came down between singer and hearer. The sect's fundamentals affirmed, sans admittance and argument, that between song head heard and throat sung the shadow showed, that not even the king himself comprehended his deepest glories. And the Pre-Armyite denomination was but one. Amongst the Elvi were the hosts of Memphis, the shaken, rattled, and rolled, the River Jordanaires, the Gracelandians, the Vegasians, the Gladysians, the Sea of E now or never, the redeemed believers in our Master's voice, the Church of the True Assumption of His Burning Love, and 100 dozen more. Each schism knew their king true and saw their road as sole and only. Their only given was that, for whatever reason, and they supposed, at no one's command, the king would return. Mama says mine is a night mind. Random acts of senseless violence is the diary of a 12-year-old girl who, through forces beyond her control, has to take the wrong path in life. She's with her girlfriend this evening, and she's hearing about an urban legend of what she's always wondered, and she wonders if it is legend or if it's true. It was late, but I wanted to stay awake to be with Iz and know I was with her. Tell me about the decons, I said. She necklaced me with her arms and put her lips on my ear and started whispering in between kisses. The decons be bad evilness, the worst of worst, Iz said. They prime night crawlers, they soul slashers, they roll when it darken and nobody see their shadow. Everybody run when the decons come. Naturals, intercrime, pit bulls, all of them. anything that happened bad nightside gets done by decons. What do? I asked. They steal the babies. They pack the crack. They do the drive-by, make everybody bleed. Nobody know who the first decon be, but whoever they was, they did the king's strut early on. Decons in total control. When the street light blink, they snuff it. When the rats sneak streetways, they right behind. You get in the subway and you solo in the car, you jump back out at that stop because the decons get you for the next. Police can't catch the decons. Army can't catch them. Gangsta boys couldn't catch them if they wanted. Nobody catch the decons, but even if they caught, they still be round. Jude said Weeze was a decon now. How did she join? I remember asking, feeling sleepier and sleepier. The decons know where the lines be before people, the lines they never crossed before. They get you to cross your line. When you cross it, you with the decons, and you never come back. Look about, people. Beef me over long, and I ground bound you express. Down, 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 you go down, and I be bottomed out, set to catch. Snatch your whispers and tape what plays. Hit rewind and scream you to sleep. Siren your ass and X you proper. Look about, all you. Spec your mirror, there I be. Crazy evilness be my design, if that's what needs wearing. All people here bound, be evil souled, heart side, no ho, they sweet talk. Shove, do push, and push, do shove, and everybody in this world leave love lost hereafter. Look about, chase me if you want. Funny face me if you keen, but mark this, when I go chasing, I go catching. I cautious when you step out, people, cause I be running street wild come nightside, and nobody safes when I ride. I bite. Can't cut me now. Can't fuck me now. Can't hurt me now. No more. No more. Night, 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 night. I'm with the decons now. From my Russia novel, Let's Put the Future Behind Us, which isn't science fiction, but I've been told is the most science fictional of everything I've done. It's all in the nature of the game. The narrator, our hero, has a vision. I am no starets, no holy man, no doomsaying Cassandra. Apocalyptic visions do not bombard my waking life, and premonitions of coming days never force me into making my Linnaean prophecies for which I can be held accountable. But later that night, when at last I fell asleep, leaving my troubles behind in the sunlit world, I dreamed. In my dream, I possessed the power of ubiquity. I dreamed of Moscow and the radiant future it had been denied in waking life, and this is what I saw. Many storied buildings rose throughout the city, their designs a thousand years ahead of our time. Oval towers bridged by skywalks, glass pyramids glowing like braziers, bundles of steel tubes held aright by guy wires, gold domed cylinders of granite and green tile. Through the black iron latticework of the Tatlin Tower ascended a cyclopean glass ball into which was etched a map of the world, each country made of sparkling red rubies. Rising above all was the Palace of Soviets, 300 stories in the style of the Tower of Babel. At its apex was an aluminum statue of Lenin, 100 meters high. Two red searchlights beamed constantly from his eyes, directing all into the path of his mesmeric stare. Squadrons of 10-engined airplanes with half-kilometer wingspans soared in formation through the night sky, their fuselages emblazoned with socialist realist figures illuminated by tail-mounted searchlights, their loudspeakers endlessly blaring agitprop into the atmosphere. Autogyros buzzed like bees over the city. Carmine Zeppelins cruised in elegant progression high above black clouds curling up from 10,000 smokestacks. Boulevards, 20 lanes wide, ran from the Kremlin in every direction. The river, enlarged by voluntary prison labor into a deep ocean harbor, provided Moscow with a seacoast almost bohemian in its grandeur. Ships docked to load up our national products, goods transported from Stalingrad, Stalinsk, Stalino, Stalinbad, Stalinir, Stalinkhan, and Stalinovo, goods to be sent forth to a waiting world. Caviar and sables, vodka and Paparossi, heroin and hashish, plutonium and red mercury, balalaikas, matryoshkas, lapel pins, rayon banners, platinum busts of our leaders and koipu. Posters of milkmaids, gymnasts, weightlifters, folk dancers, tractor drivers, miners, soldiers, and all for whom labor is a matter of honor, papered every building's facade. Red neon signs mounted to the Kremlin walls proclaimed, "Cannibalism is forbidden. Let's catch up with and surpass Africa. We'll open a women's shop. Through whipping to socialism, who is killing whom?" As I watched, Moscow's surviving citizens emerged from their buildings. In silent procession, they marched into Red Square. From every streetlight hung relatives of friends of enemies of the people. Trams ran on bone lines. In bookstores, works sold were bound in the skin of the authors. Skulls sprouted from the earth like mushrooms in the city's great parks. Impaled upon the spires of Stalin's seven skyscrapers were the swollen heads of old Bolsheviks, Trotsky, Zinoviev, Kamenev, Radek, Bukharin, Rykov, and Krupskaya. The assembled populace applauded wildly as they watched the moon, gleaming like chains, white as a silver fist, rise high over Soviet land. No one in the crowd wanted to be the first to stop clapping. The ever-intensifying ovation continued. Palms stung, fingers swelled, blisters burst. People clapped the skin from their flesh. Tendons sprang loose of muscle, muscle slipped from bone, and still the applause grew louder. Bloody spray resettled as opaque fog, enshrouding the crowd. As the people vanished within the red cloud, they continued to cheer the moon for having delivered the darkness they craved. In the moon's face was the silent, mustachioed face of the Father of Night, the man after our own hearts, the man who missed nothing, the man who forever found you out, the man who knew you better than you would ever know yourself. Why did no one realize that if we built hell on earth, there would be nothing to look forward to? Thank you. Lastly, on a more bucolic note, a nonfiction piece. William Gibson's German publisher had me write a foreword to the new edition of Neuromancer, which has now been picked up by the American, so it'll be appearing as an afterword in the 20th anniversary edition. William is an old friend of mine, and we have considerable in common outside of science fiction. And so, I wanted to read a little excerpt from this piece, because sonically I think it works quite well. When we did at last meet, it was in 1991 at a party here in New York for the Difference Engine. Most of the usual local suspects were present, zeroing in on the action. And so, wherever possible, we hide ourselves to more secure parts of the room, the better to escape the purveyors of Phonus Bellonus. He gave me a copy of Cormac McCarthy's Blood Meridian, and I told him about that day's big news in New York, the finding of a box of frozen human heads down on Avenue A, said box having apparently tumbled off a truck en route to the cryogenics clinic. Suffice to say, we were as impressed with one another in person, in our own inimitable ways, as we had been at a distance. He and I knew from the start that we had much in common, little of which involved science fiction. At the instant each of us first heard the other speak and detected in our voices a familiar tonality, we realized we were members of the same tribe. Although Bill had been living in British Columbia for well over 20 years, and that year in New York was my 12th, we had both started out as boys of the mountains and valleys, the hills and the hollers, as folk still say, down there. We'd grown up on either side of the sclerotic spine of the Eastern Mountains. He in Virginia, not far into the post-war era, and me in Kentucky, 8 years after that. The importance of his beginnings to what Gibson has written and continues to write may perhaps be hard to grasp for those who imagine that past and future, like oil and water, are discrete entities, but its magnitude cannot and must not be ignored. Cyberspace is infinite, but starts with each person who chooses to step into it. And I speak now of he who in the first place dreamed it into life. Cyberspace was born where the laurel grows lush and verdant, where the dogwoods blossom and the whippoorwills cry in the wind-whipped limbs of the tulip trees. It was born between the ridges, deep in the glades where streams rush cold along their limestone courses, born high on the mountainsides not yet strip mined for their coal atop the lone green knobs of Mars. The Southern Highlands, this region was once called, we now call it Appalachia. This part of the United States has been since the Revolution, and even now to some degree remains, not merely rural, but distant, in time as well as place. Its light filters down through the branches from another world's sun. Bill Gibson remembered that world, however often or for whatever reasons he might try to forget it. He remembered the raw-boned old men with faces lined like dry riverbeds, sun-bleached fedoras on their heads and white shirts beneath their overalls as they hoed the fields. Remembered the five-and-dime store with wooden floors worn glass smooth and countertops lined with trays top full of marbles, notions, and gem crackery. He recalled the sound of a fired gun echoing off the hill on the far side of an autumnal field, and the mysterious way a shard of grand parental history excavated during some slow summer afternoon, whether in the basement's icebox or the attic's bake oven, could possess such limitless fascination. He still understood the nature of the private commentary of men, cognizant of the sort of words and kind of phrasing barbershop regulars stopped using the moment a stranger or mother stepped through the door. He still saw the stare and the eyes of old women who might have been recalling the day their husbands headed east to the Western Front, or the look on their fathers' faces when they heard that a friend wouldn't be coming back from the hole. He still tapped a foot to radio ballads as they poured ethereally from a barn dance or fiddle festival two states away, marking the rhythm in the same manner as did the community elders, although unlike him, the ancients remembered a day when everything they heard would be heard solely in the instant it was produced, never again, and leaving no more lasting trace than snowflakes falling onto the tongue. And he could still listen to the far-off plaint of a train horn as the express rolled through the night, wailing through a darkness lit solely by moon and fireflies, a sound that planted in his mind the awareness that one day he too would travel far away from that country of heart and home, would necessarily flee as if pursued by hounds, a world that essentialed abrogation as it demanded honorific, a sound endlessly entrancing, yet infinitely sad, the unignorable siren call of the wider world without. The wider world waited, and he would go there. I remember these things too, and this is how I know where cyberspace was born. Thank you very much.